We're closing out the year on Wisconsin politics, and a major portion of the 2017 book could be devoted to the Taiwanese electronics firm Foxconn, a potential $10 billion investment that would create 13,000 jobs. It made headlines for months. We'll revisit this big political and economic development story and many others this hour. It's the year in Wisconsin politics on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sean Johnson is our guide. He's Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can follow him on Twitter at SJohnsonWPR. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we'll get to Foxconn in just a bit, but first, let's start with who made job changes in 2017. Some forced, some not. Resumes being updated in Wisconsin government and politics. Sean, who made career moves?
I think one is pretty notable, and that is Reince Priebus. You know, when you think about Reince Priebus, if we were talking about him 12 years ago, he would be known in Wisconsin politics as a failed candidate for state senate. And that was kind of his political resume, somebody who'd worked on political campaigns for other people, run himself, and didn't get there. And in 2017, we're talking about him as the first White House chief of staff for President Donald Trump, somebody who navigated the 2016 election chaos, sided with Trump, earned his trust, and, you know, became one of many competing figures in a White House. And, you know, somebody who ultimately left and had one of the shortest tenures of any White House chief of staff in history. So Reince Priebus kind of reminds you of what a tumultuous year it's been. And, you know, it seems like a long time ago that he was sworn in as White House chief of staff and left. It was all this year.
I remember those exit interviews on the talk shows, the political talk shows, and how he said he had no regrets. He did the work, and he was feeling good about it.
There are different ways to leave a job like that, aren't there? Especially given, you know, all the strife that was reported from unnamed sources in a lot of national news between Priebus and Bannon and, you know, other figures who have also left the White House now. Priebus never said, you know, they're doing it wrong or anything like that. And now he is actually doing pretty well for himself. I mean, he's working for Michael Best and Friedrich, the Milwaukee law firm that he was working for when he was in Wisconsin, only now he is based in Washington. And he's not technically a lobbyist, I believe, but he helps connect corporate clients to the White House using his, you know, his knowledge of how things get done and his vast connections in Washington, D.C. Yeah, when you don't storm out of a place and say they're done, he didn't burn any bridges. And so, you know, Reince Priebus, he's still in the thick of it. You're just not going to hear from him as much anymore.
A lesson in that story, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Other notable departures in 2018.
We had a couple in Wisconsin. So Kathy Stepp was one of Governor Scott Walker's original cabinet secretaries. She's not the only one to leave the Walker cabinet, but I think she was probably the one who's best known among his secretaries. Kathy Stepp is somebody who, when she was in the state Senate, actually made a career out of attacking the Department of Natural Resources. You know, mm-hmm. She always had kind of a mindset for what builders and developers were looking into in disputes with the DNR.
Critics said she didn't have enough of the research and science background, right?
She did not have that background, but so she came at the job from a different perspective and mm-hmm. wanted to make it a more business-friendly agency. And under her tenure, it'd be hard to argue that they didn't do that. She moved on for an EPA job. So Kathy Stepp is, you know, one of those initial Walker cabinet secretaries in one of those high-profile agencies.
Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark resigned.
Yes, David Clark was becoming, the longer he was in Wisconsin politics, the more outspoken he was becoming. And he is somebody who seized on this Trump momentum in 2016 in a big way and definitely attached himself to that and had a similar style to the president, really. I mean, he wouldn't just kind of engage his political opponents. He would insult them, and not afraid to do that. Clark leaves the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office at a time when that department was under investigation for deaths at the jail that he runs. He's moved on to working now for a super PAC, a pro-Trump super PAC, and David Clark has over the years become a fixture on like Fox News, predominantly, and a conservative spokesperson, and you know, so he can lead that life full time now.
What we remember, though, is his departure when he said that he had landed a job in the White House, and then that really wasn't the case, or it hadn't come out, and there was this back and forth as to was he really going to the White House or not.
That was definitely unusual, the way that it ended. Yeah, there was talk that he was done, and he was going. He said he was going for a job in the Trump White House, and he didn't. You know, that never happened. So an unusual way for him to leave.
We're recapping the year in politics with Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We're moving on now to the state budget. It was late, a couple months late, jammed up by how to pay for roads. What were some of the takeaways in the state budget when it did finally pass?
I think any year that you have a budget, so every 2 years we should talk about the budget as one of the big political stories or the big government stories of that year. It's just, in Wisconsin especially, it is just that bill that kind of sucks up every other bill. You know, if you want to get something passed, you put it in the budget because it's that one bill that they have to pass in Wisconsin government. And so a lot of stuff gets attached to the budget. And it is the bill that usually defines a governor and a legislature. I think the kind of the defining characteristic of this budget was all of the very public Republican infighting on the budget. It's just something you haven't seen under Republicans to that degree since they took control of state government in 2011. You know, this was it felt like from the beginning, Voss versus Walker. Walker versus Voss. There was a lot of stress there, predominantly over transportation.
Remind us, too, of why there was such infighting, why this transportation issue was such a big, big deal.
I think basically because we've reached a point in Wisconsin where transportation, you know, roads, which legislators and governors have always liked to fund, have always liked to build, you know, that they're a tangible reminder of what state government does. Hey, constituent, we helped build that road. There's just not the money to build them to the degree that Wisconsin has in the past without going deeper and deeper into debt. And so you had some Republicans led by Assembly Speaker Voss who had kind of come to that. They reached that point where they've said, okay, we have to do something other than what we've been doing. We're going to call for some kind of a tax or fee increase. You know, essentially, we're going to change the way things have been going. And then you had Governor Scott Walker on the other side, who's running for re-election in 2018, take what initially seemed like a pretty strong stand against taxes or fees. And then, you know, that became more of a hard line as talks went on. It seemed like there might be wiggle room early in the, you know, the budget process. But as it went on, it was pretty clear that he wasn't going to budge on that.
Remind us how K-12 schools and the UW fared with money in the budget.
Yeah, that was, especially with K-12 schools, that was an issue where you could, you know, there was just such a big change in Walker's budget compared to his previous budgets in terms of the amount of state money that he set aside for state schools. You know, in the ballpark of $650 million in new funding, that is something that you hadn't seen from Governor Walker in previous budgets. And so, I mean, it was along the lines of what his now potential political opponent, Tony Evers, state superintendent of public instruction, officially nonpartisan but now running for governor as a Democrat, it's along the lines of what Tony Evers wanted for schools. You know, it's in that ballpark. Evers would have funded schools differently, but in this budget, it was a win for him and a win for a lot of the school groups. So on that issue where Walker has kind of been, you know, presented by those groups as a villain in previous budgets. He gave him what he wanted this time. Again, he is running for re-election in 2018. I think you have to remind yourself of that when you look at all these issues and how they're approached by any governor.
We're taking a journey through state politics in 2017. From the budget we've been talking about to Foxconn next, to the Supreme Court and beyond, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson stays with us on this look back on and look ahead on 2018. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What do you think was the biggest state political story of the year? Was it generally a step forward or a step backward for Wisconsin, and why? What would you like to see lawmakers work on in 2018? 800-642-1234. We'll return after a check of the latest news. What political stories in Wisconsin did you focus on this year? What grabbed your attention that has big implications for the state? We're taking a look back at Wisconsin politics in 2017 on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're also getting a preview of what's in store for 2018 at the state capitol with WPR's Sean Johnson. He keeps tabs on all the state government developments as Capitol Bureau Chief. Your thoughts on the year in politics, 800-642-1234. What do you consider as the biggest state political story of 2017? How do you hope the U.S. Supreme Court rules on our state's legislative maps? What questions do you have about a state political issue as we head into the new year? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, Sean, Foxconn, that one single word, such a big deal in the state as it won the Foxconn contract, beating out other states. Remind us of what this development was in 2017.
Yeah, we're not doing this look back as a top 10 of, you know, or ranking them or anything.
However, we're slightly out of order.
But if we were, I think I might put this one number one, because it seems like it's such a big deal to different people for different reasons. You know, for Scott Walker landing Foxconn a commitment from Taiwanese tech giant Foxconn to build a massive manufacturing plant in southeast Wisconsin to build screens for televisions, you know, that was a huge political feather in his cap, you know, that he looked at it as, and his allies looked at it as kind of a vindication for all the pro-business policies that Wisconsin had put in place over the years, from right to work to this manufacturer's tax credit, which basically zeroes out the tax burden for manufacturers in Wisconsin. And, you know, the fact that Wisconsin was competing for this plant against other states, for Walker and, you know, Republicans here and Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation here to get Foxconn, to them was a huge win. For Democrats, it is a huge blunder. You know, they look at it not as the reward of potentially getting this large plant, but they're looking at the other side of that ledger and the $3 billion plus, really, that the state of Wisconsin and local governments will give to this corporation, which is very well off financially as it is. I mean, this is not like just a tax incentive. You know, this is potentially $3 billion in cash payments to this company, because Foxconn is already likely not going to pay any taxes in Wisconsin because of that manufacturer's tax credit that we just mentioned there. And so this is saying that if the company makes a large capital investment, you know, builds this big plant and hires so many people, that it will qualify for checks from the state of Wisconsin over several years. You know, you're talking about a couple $100 million a year that the state could be paying to this company.
We were hearing a return on investment on this deal looking into 2042-ish.
It was like 20. Yeah, it was in the 2040s. And when you talk about return on investment, that's when will the state start being kind of a winner in terms of the amount of money being spent on this, the amount of tax revenue being spent on this versus the amount of tax revenue being generated by Foxconn, and not just Foxconn, but surrounding businesses. You know, that's looking at the economic impact and assuming a lot of other businesses and a lot of other jobs are spun off. That's how they arrived at that number. There was a Legislative Fiscal Bureau that came up with that number or calculated that number.
We also heard from environmentalists very concerned about how Foxconn will deal with the environment in terms of the water use. There were those issues as well.
Yeah, that bill makes a number of exemptions for Foxconn that, you know, other companies don't get automatically when it comes to building and what Foxconn has to, the hoops that they have to jump through in terms of building on wetlands, all sorts of changes were made. And, you know, we should mention at a time when Wisconsin lawmakers and the governor couldn't agree on how to fund roads for the rest of the state, they did agree on how to fund a massive interstate expansion down by Foxconn. They set aside, substantial funding for that.
And there was a leadership shakeup in the Democratic Party.
There was. And this shows you, like, what a hot-button issue this has become. Democrat Peter Barca of Kenosha, whose district would be very close to this Foxconn plant. Peter Barca was the Assembly Minority Leader for several years in Wisconsin, led Assembly Democrats through the battle over, you know, Wisconsin Act 10, had kind of a thankless job over the years in a way, because Democrats have been so deep in the minority that it's been hard for them to affect any public policy. Peter Barca voted for the Foxconn bill, and shortly after that, he was, you know, pushed out as minority leader.
And who became the new minority leader?
Gordon Hintz is the new minority leader. Gordon Hintz is somebody who has experience on the legislature's budget committee, state representative from Oshkosh. And I'm not sure we know enough about Gordon Hintz's, you know, leadership style, or that he has enough of a track record to say how it compares to Barca. He's got his first test kind of in the 2018 elections in terms of what he can do and, you know, if he can win back some of those seats that Democrats have steadily lost over the years.
Talking right now with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. We are rewinding on 2017 in Wisconsin politics. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What stood out to you? What legislation did you closely follow this year? What state political news was confusing? Add your voice, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean, perhaps one highlight of 2017 for you was being able to go out and cover the Supreme Court proceedings as we saw the Supreme Court take up Wisconsin's legislative redistricting case.
Yeah, I think another nomination for Story of the Year there if we were doing a list, because it's not often that a case gets heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, and they heard ours. And not only did they hear a case from Wisconsin, it's the first partisan gerrymandering claim that they've really considered in more than a decade at the court. And it could be, this could be the last time that the court looks at this issue for the next decade or more. And so when we're talking about partisan gerrymandering, typically when a redistricting plan is challenged in courts, and redistricting is the process that legislatures go through every 10 years after the census. Mm-hmm. In theory, you're just redrawing these legislative boundaries to make sure that they all have equal population and they follow a number of other redistricting criteria. Typically, when those get challenged in court, they're challenged along other grounds, you know, whether it was like a racial gerrymander, for example, and it diminished the power of a minority population to elect, the representative of their choice, stuff like that. There's always been this assumption in the courts that partisanship is kind of a baked in ingredient of redistricting, that you have partisans drawing these maps. There will always be a certain degree of partisanship, and courts have stayed out of deciding when, you know, partisan becomes too partisan. The Wisconsin case seeks to change that. They're trying to tell the court, Wisconsin's gerrymander, that when Republicans drew the map in 2011, that they drew it so partisan that it was a partisan gerrymander that silenced the voices of Democratic voters in Wisconsin. And so they're asking the court to step in and say there is a line you can cross when a map is too partisan. They crossed it in Wisconsin, and they want the court to set a standard for future cases.
Well, not all of the justices were on the same page with this. As you listen to those oral arguments at the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts was worried it would open the floodgates to lawsuits.
Yes, you had dire warnings from both sides on this. And attorneys always caution into reading too much into what justices say on the bench during arguments, because they're up there to play devil's advocate. But John Roberts seemed to be telegraphing what his thoughts were on this case. Yeah, he was saying that if the court gets into this, it's just going to be one lawsuit after another that's going to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, and that will tarnish the court's reputation. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts.
I would think if the claim is allowed to proceed, there will naturally be a lot of these claims raised around the country. Politics is a very important driving force, and those claims will be raised. And every one of them will come here for a decision on the merits. These cases are not within our discretionary jurisdiction. They're the mandatory jurisdiction. We will have to decide in every case whether the Democrats win or the Republicans win. So it's going to be a problem here across the board.
And then on the other side of that, you had attorneys who were bringing this case say, well, you know, that may well be that this is difficult for the court to step into. But if you don't, these gerrymanders are only going to get more and more severe. That technology has advanced to a point where they can so precisely draw the lines, the majority party in Wisconsin, it's Republicans, in other states, it's Democrats. They can so precisely draw the lines that you are silencing the voices of voters from the other party, and pushing them out of the process.
But in 2017, we also heard of this mathematical litmus test, if you will.
You did this efficiency gap.
This efficiency gap.
Which is what they when plaintiffs brought this case, they had this new metric that researchers at the University of Chicago and elsewhere came up with. Political scientists at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. They have moved away from the efficiency gap as the be all end all of measuring gerrymanders. They have said it's one test of many that lets you look at when a map is too partisan. That it's more important for the court to kind of set up a test for these cases and then proceed to these other metrics. And if you have a pretty clear gerrymander, all the metrics kind of point in that same direction. So they have moved away from that a little bit. And I'm not sure what the court's going to do in light of that. But you did hear some justices on the court were sympathetic to that argument. Again, these are their comments on the bench, but it seemed like a few of the justices were telegraphing. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, you know, I understand your concerns over lawsuits, but what about the concern over voters? Here's Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I would like to ask you what's really behind all of this. The precious right to vote. If you can stack a legislature in this way, what incentive is there for a voter to exercise his vote? Whether it's a Democratic district or a Republican district, the result using this map, the result is preordained in most of the districts.
So Ruth Bader Ginsburg, along with other justices on that court who were appointed by Democratic presidents, all sounding like they are willing to kind of jump into this fray. The most of the Republican nominees sounding like they did not want to go here. And then you have Justice Anthony Kennedy in the middle, a Reagan appointee, but somebody who said more than a decade ago that partisan gerrymandering troubles him and that he was open to courts stepping into this issue. You have Justice Anthony Kennedy in the middle, and we're all basically waiting to find out what he thinks about this argument. And there is a chance that the court could rule on this as soon as February, potentially.
Oh, wow, because we had heard perhaps next summer.
And it could be. It's the court. You know, it could be like June 30th. But you have... I've just heard a range of predictions that start with maybe February, March at the earliest, and June at the latest. The trouble with waiting till June is that if the court were to throw out Wisconsin's map, then you know, the electoral process, or you know, the process of candidates circulating papers, getting on the ballot, all that stuff has already happened in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So there's some pressure for the court to act. Then again, they are the court, and maybe they don't feel that pressure because they set the rules.
Meanwhile, I think I just read this morning that they've taken another case out of Maryland.
Yes, they have. And, you know, there are a couple different theories on what that might mean. It could be that, you know, the one theory from people who kind of want the court to step in on this issue and say, yes, you can have maps that are too partisan. One theory is that they took that Maryland case because it shows a map that was gerrymandered by Democrats. It gives the court some political cover to say, look, we're not taking sides in this issue. Both parties do it. We're going to say that you can't, you know, that you can't do it in Wisconsin.
And that is
or
true.
Maryland.
Both parties do it.
They do. The competing thought is that the fact that they're taking that Maryland case suggests that they're not interested in the Wisconsin case, that justices expressed some concerns with the Wisconsin case in terms of standing. That is, who can bring a lawsuit like this? Why should a voter in Madison be able to challenge the entire legislative map when, you know, they're not harmed by what happens in a district up in northern Wisconsin necessarily?
We shall stay tuned, of course, in 2018. But moving on right now, some big environmental issues and legislation. Wisconsin Republicans siding with business, both on high-capacity well restrictions that were eased and the sulfide mining moratorium. Can you break down those quickly here?
Those are a couple of big issues that have been... you know, they've been, you know, restrictions on the books for years, and they were lifted this year. And the sulfide mining moratorium is something that Republican Governor Tommy Thompson signed over concerns about what sulfide mining and the process of sulfide mining, which is more dangerous than, you know, iron mining. That moratorium was there to protect against that risk. And so Republicans in lifting that moratorium, and we're talking about sulfide mining, we're talking about like gold and other, you know, minerals like that. They're saying that they feel like they can do that inherently risky activity safely now. And so they've opened the door to, you know, that type of mining happening in Wisconsin.
And whereby creating more jobs for the state.
Yes, potentially. Although you didn't hear them sell that as much this time as they did the last time there was a big mining bill in Wisconsin. There was this big proposal to build an iron mine in northern Wisconsin. It was going to be the biggest economic development project in the history of the state, according to some people. And it did not materialize. You know, there is no mine up there despite that bill. So not quite the sales pitch that you heard a few years ago.
We're recalling the year it was in state politics with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll return after a check of the latest news. In Wisconsin politics, we're preparing to close it down and look ahead to 2018. We're recalling the state political developments this hour, like the resolution calling for a constitutional convention, which would basically require Congress to pass balanced federal budgets. Wisconsin is the 28th state to call for a convention that would add a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. 34 states have to call for such a convention for it to be held. Governor Scott Walker signed that bill last month. We're talking about this and other state government milestones this hour with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You can join this conversation on this recap and look ahead at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the biggest state political story of 2017? Was this year a step forward or step backward for Wisconsin, and why? What would you like to see lawmakers work on in 2018? What questions do you have about a state political issue as we head into the new year? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, we also heard, Sean, about this the Constitutional Convention. Where did Wisconsin end up on this?
Wisconsin joined the call. You know, this is one of those issues that we have to kind of couch this one. There's a chance that they never get enough states to call this particular convention, or that they do many, many, many years in the future. So to look back at what happened this year in Wisconsin and say that's a step that lawmakers took that will have immediate consequences. It's not, you know, it may never mean anything. It could be totally theoretical. But what they're talking about doing and what Wisconsin has endorsed is the first ever convention of states in, you know, the United States since the Constitution was a thing in 1787. So it's a potentially huge deal. And the reason that backers are calling for this, and this is something that's supported by Republicans in Wisconsin, is they say that government debt has grown out of control so much that it's, you know, endangering not only the American way of life, but national security. Senator Dave Craig, a Republican from the town of Vernon, was one of the lead sponsors in the Senate. And so he said, in a situation like that, it's the state's duty to act.
Article 5 was put in place specifically for the situation in which Congress, the federal government, needs assistance from the states, by which, under our Constitution, the federal government derives its power, to somehow say on this body's floor that this is not within our purview is ridiculous.
So that was met with Democratic concerns over what this constitutional convention could potentially do. And what they're saying, and this is backed up by constitutional scholars, is that if you call a convention like this, the delegates aren't necessarily bound to only consider the issue for which the convention was called.
So that was the biggest worry about this.
That you have this convention of states and these delegates who suddenly become tremendously powerful and have the ability to propose any amendments to the Constitution. This is something, an issue that was raised by State Senator Kathleen Vinehout, a Democrat from Alma. She's also a candidate for governor.
As rewriters of the United States Constitution, the delegates become the sovereign power in the land. More powerful than the United States Congress, more powerful than the United States Supreme Court, more powerful than the United States President.
So they did pass bills along, a bill along with this and another resolution saying, no delegates, this is what we want you to do, you know, that the delegates would be there to deal with a balanced budget amendment, nothing more. But again, their hands would not be constitutionally tied. So, of course, if we had a first ever convention of states with Wisconsin endorsing that call, this would be a very big deal.
Well, we have Marcus in Milwaukee who would like to add to this particular point. Marcus, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I feel that if they call the Constitutional Convention, that this would be a monumental mistake on the part of all Americans, given our political climate and how divisive it currently is, that, again, without having their hands tied and they'd be able to do whatever, you can only imagine where this is going to end up going. I mean, as they've already done in the Senate by exercising the nuclear option and taking it to less than a two-thirds majority, in order to pass legislation, I mean, this can get really dangerous. I believe the founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, they were very, very smart men, and they thought about how to avoid tyranny in all its forms and created a document that was as near perfection as been seen on this planet for a government in pretty much all of history. And I think that it's a mistake if we're to do this.
So, Marcus, this is going to be on your radar in 2018.
Absolutely.
Well, Sean, how would you respond to that?
I love this issue because, it's just a debate that don't typically hear in the state legislature talking about the founders to this degree. And I think the response that you heard from backers of this plan was that, well, those founders put this option in that document, you know, that they left it open to states to do this. It's something that hasn't been exercised in the past, but they wanted to have that kind of escape valve potentially. The idea that, you know, this is another concern that was raised by critics of this plan is this idea that American democracy is not at its most stable right now, you know, potentially that it is a pretty divided nation and a little more chaotic than we're used to. So to throw something in there like this would be, even more destabilizing.
Marcus, thanks so much for the call. And moving on, Sean, youth hunting got a lot of headlines in 2017. We were seeing headlines about toddlers being able to go hunting. Let's recall the youth hunting bill.
Yeah, the youth hunting bill says that you can go on a mentored hunt in Wisconsin without any age limit. So this is something that I think just a handful of kids under 10 maybe exercised in Wisconsin. But it does speak to the hunting culture here. You did have a bipartisan vote for this one. This is another issue that got a lot of attention.
We also had continued troubles at Lincoln Hills.
Continued troubles at the state's youth correctional center. You know, that there is, it seems like, reports regularly in the Wisconsin State Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about another disruption at that facility, and you know whether guards there, corrections officers there, are being too tough with the juveniles that are in that facility. And then the flip side of that, whether because they're under restrictions now from a judge, whether the juveniles in that facility know that, and they're being, they're messing with the guards even more and endangering the safety there. So that's something that will continue in 2018.
And we're on lightning round here. We're moving
2018.
On. We're moving on to John Doe 3. That's been in recent headlines, which brings us to December of 2017.
Yeah, this is it's complicated. The John Doe is an issue that's...
So that doesn't qualify for lightning round.
I don't know how we can get through this in 20 seconds, but the John Doe investigation into Governor Scott Walker's campaign it was ended a couple years ago. The agency that investigated it, the GAB, took part in that investigation.
Government Accountability Board.
The Government Accountability Board. They are gone. And what's happened is there's been an investigation into that investigation by Wisconsin's Attorney General that was critical of the GAB for the way that it handled documents. And now Republicans in the legislature are calling for the leaders of the new Ethics and Elections Commissions, which replaced the Government Accountability Board, to step down, even though those people weren't charged with anything and they have the support of their board. So that's one of those developing issues that may come to a head in early 2018 if the state Senate and Republicans in the state Senate try to push those people out, even though they haven't been charged with anything, and again, their boards support them.
Will we see a challenge to having these John Doe investigations in 2018?
So that's another change that's already happened. Republicans have already restricted John Doe investigations, which are like a grand jury, but with just a judge. So there's semi-secret investigations. Judges give prosecutors more power to obtain evidence. Those have already been restricted for anything having to do with politics or campaign finance. So, again, Republicans have already taken a number of these steps. The John Doe is done. The agency that investigated is done. And the law by which these investigations were carried out has been changed, but we continue to talk about John Doe and will do so for the next few months probably.
Word on the street, there are some elections in 2018.
Yeah, we're going to need another 10 minutes just to read the candidates here for governor. It's a primary like we have never seen before in generations, at least. And that's a vague term, but I just haven't. I don't know the last time Wisconsin had this many candidates in a primary for governor, the Democratic primary for governor. Even when you whittle that list down to people who either have kind of campaign organizational support, you know, they can finance their campaign, or people who have political experience, it's a long list. You're looking at nine people by that metric there, nine Democrats who are running in a primary trying to take on Governor Scott Walker.
So what's the reasoning behind that? Why would so many people pull, you know, throw their hat in the ring?
This is, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it sort of feeds upon itself at this point. Talking to an expert who follows these races around the country, she said that she's seeing big Democratic fields all over the country because the Democratic Party is fired up because of Donald Trump and Republicans in Washington.
Will the money be there?
They want to change. Well, you know, the thing is, I think it's that there's going to be money that flows into the Wisconsin race, no doubt. It's just a matter of timing. You know, for 8 months, there's going to be potentially nine candidates kind of duking it out on the Democratic side. Is that good for the party? Is it bad for the party? That's the debate whenever you have a big primary. Do they bruise each other up and then, you know, they spend less time talking about each other or less time talking about the governor than themselves? Or by having that big primary, do they draw more attention to Democrats this year?
Time is of an essence, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. You can follow him on Twitter, SJohnsonWPR. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Nyasia Ellison with technical direction from Dave Potraz. Michelle Johnson is our executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation is on the Ideas Network.